Comeback Ready is the story of the making of the fifth and most commercially successful album by the band The Clash. Comeback Rock as an album was released in 1982, and after reading every book about The Clash that he could lay his hands on, our guest this morning felt it was time to write his own book and cover as much ground as he could about the band and about that particular album and that particular period in time for the band The Clash. In the studio with me this morning is the author of this new book, Tim Satchwell. Morning to you, Tim.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Cambridge.
And I've been looking forward to talking to you. You're both locally based, but you're here with your wife this morning, Pauline, who's also in the studio. Tim, your passion for The Clash, does it come from your childhood?
It's a bit strange one because a lot of people say, you know, I was sort of 14, 15 around the time, I didn't see The Clash in their very earliest days. I saw them on by the time they did their second album, Comeback Rock. But it made quite an impression on me. That album, there's so much power. They came on stage and it just kind of knocked you back when they came on. The volume and the kind of adrenaline was really going there. So I followed them, you know, through their albums. I listened to a lot of other stuff. A lot of people are kind of like, you know, oh, it was only ever The Clash, but there was a lot of other stuff I listened to, a lot of other bands, especially from the kind of punk time. That's really when I first got really, really interested in music, and I worked in record shops, and I just had such a great time. So this has always been a real passion of mine, music, and particularly the Clash now, later in life, mean a lot more to me than possibly a lot of the other bands that were around at the time.
Do you know, when we look back in our more mature years, shall we say, you and me, to some of those good musical times, the late 1970s, early 1980s, it was such a tremendous time because there was also such a variety of music. We think, of course, The Clash as a genre as well, bands like The Cure, fantastic talents.
Yeah, what's great, I mean, the thing is that I think a lot of people, there's this kind of image now. You talk to, Pauline, my wife, a teacher, but she talks to students and she might talk about punk to them, and then to them it's something completely different. They all think it's demonic or whatever, you know, everyone dresses in black and all this kind of stuff. But you know, punk, when punk hit, there was such a variety, even those early days, such a variety of music. You know, you did have a kind of Sex Pistols kind of like, you know, full on, you know, in your face stuff, but you also had the early sort of electronic music. There was a band called Spiz Oil, whatever they were at the time. Quite a lot of really different stuff. And that's what, although it was sort of lumped in as punk, it was incredibly eclectic, I think. And just fantastic. You opened my ears to a lot of stuff and also a lot of reggae stuff, dub reggae stuff, which was around at the time, and there was this kind of meshing and moulding together of kind of reggae and punk, and The Clash were quite, you know, ahead of that. You know, they covered Police and Thieves on their first album, and fantastic. And I was actually I was in a shop in the post office yesterday. Some guy working in the post office, and I had my Clash jacket on here. And he's like a West Indian guy, and he just said, "Ah, The Clash." He said, "Yeah, I love that first album. You know, it's like reggae, and it was like rebel stuff." And he said, "I just was so into punk," and that was the great thing about it, and particularly The Clash, because they did seem to bring together a lot of different groups of people. And the energy they had, the kind of you know, standing up for people and the way they treated their fans was just tremendous. You know, they'd let people in for nothing and, you know, treat them really well. They were just a great band to you know, to follow and stuff.
So people were getting into gigs for free then, Tim. The lineup: Joe Strummer, of course, the fabulous Joe Strummer, who was the lead, the backing vocals, guitar, harmonica and piano. Mick Jones on the guitar, backing and lead vocals, keyboards and sound effects. Paul Simonon, bass guitarist, backing vocals and the lead vocals on Red Angel Dragnet on the album as well. And Topper Heaton, can't forget him, of course, thrashing away on the drums, piano and doing bass guitar for the band as well. He was on the track Rock the Casbah, which is coming around the corner because it is just from the album. We'll actually take a break for that and then we'll come back and talk about the Clash. Before we take the track, were the Clash ever in Cambridge performing at the, say, the old Cambridge Coin Exchange before it was redone as a more of a sort of leisure entertainment centre?
You know, I don't know. I have that big, there's a famous big pink book about the Clash. I'm sure anyone who knows about the Clash will have that on their coffee table, big beast. But I can't honestly remember whether they appeared at our glorious Corn Exchange. Mm-hmm.
The album was originally called Rat Patrol. The working title of it was Rat Patrol from Fort Bragg. Why was that?
Okay, this is open to some debate, maybe. Rat Patrol was actually a TV show, a sort of 60s TV war show that had, it was like a bit like the Desert Rats, these guys. There was three Americans and one British guy, and they would hop in the Jeep and they go and wreak havoc on Rommel's troops in North Africa. So I did quite a lot of research into this, and I watched the whole series of these TV shows, because the similarities between these four guys and another certain four guys is just unbelievable. So there's these four guys with individual characters. There's a guy who's like a real good-looking guy with a hat, always wears a hat, which is like, you know, Paul Simonon for me anyway. And then there's a really kind of intellectual, kind of real thinker sort of guy. And I kind of had him down for Joe Strummer. A guy who's a, kind of like the driver of the Jeep, a main driver, and that was Topper, the drummer, because Joe used to call him the engine room, and it all kind of made perfect sense to me. And another guy who was like also a kind of thinking sort of guy was Mick Jones. So I don't know whether Mick Jones, I imagine, came up with the Rat Patrol title. I don't know whether he'd sat for hours in front of TV thinking, oh, that looks like me. But it was just amazing. I made that connection straight away. The Fort Bragg bit was because Fort Bragg was the American army base where when the Americans went to Vietnam, and when they also did their kind of naughty goings on in El Salvador and all South American stuff, that's where all the troops would be sent. That's where they would be, you know, sent. That was where they did depart from. So the Clash, particularly Joe and Mick, were very aware of the kind of all this undercover stuff that the American government were up to at the time, sort of, well, for a whole period of time, but certainly kind of like, you know, the 80s. And they just felt maybe people weren't kind of as aware of what was going on. And I think it was a kind of reference to that. I imagine that the record company, I mean, how it turned into Combat Rock is, there's a bit about that in my book, but I imagine the record company thought, what are we going to do with that title? Because it doesn't translate very well across the world.
Oh, you've got to think of it like that, haven't you? How it would translate English into other languages. Yeah.
They really wanted, so bit of a long story, read it at your leisure, but the record company, and certainly I think the band and Bernie Rhodes, the manager, had returned to be their manager. They really wanted to have a successful album, an international album. And I should think that Rat Patrol from Fort Bragg was not kind of that snappy title that the American radio stations would want to entertain. So it became Combat Rock. But again, there's a whole kind of, you know, I just looked into kind of possible theories about this in my book.
Combat Rock as an album, it was the one that truly broke the band on an international level, but also broke up the band quite literally after the album had been released. One of the band members left.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of pressure on the band to produce. I think, you know, there was just a pressure to produce a sort of like really successful album. The band just toured and toured. They just, what I really liked about Clash is they have this work ethic, which kind of like I inherited from my dad, actually. But, you know, they worked and worked and worked. They toured and toured and toured. And I don't think there are bands that today, I may be wrong, but who just like go out on the road for so long and play so many gigs. And there were pressures on the band, and there was Topper Hayden was known to have some issues, drug issues, and it just became a little difficult, I think, for them to operate with him in that condition. I would say from my research, I don't think he ever missed a beat when he played. But the kind of goings on behind the scenes, and certainly Joe and Paul Simonon felt that it was kind of hypocritical of them to sort of like stand up and say, you know, don't, you know, people don't just waste your lives and don't do this and that and don't do, you know, heavy drugs and all this kind of stuff, when a member of the band was involved in that scene. So he was fired, and I know you see documentaries with Joe Strummer, how much he absolutely regrets that, and Mick Jones was particularly upset about that. He felt he should have been given another try, but they did make an effort to kind of bring him back into the, you know, to the fold, and it just didn't work out. So that was the beginning, I guess, of the kind of almost like beginning of the end, really, when Topper went, because he was an absolute, you know, integral part of the band. And they had to bring in, they were doing an American tour, like, in a week's time. And they brought back Terry Trimes, who was the drummer who originally played with them, and he played on some of the tracks on the first album. And so he came back in, and then they were quite lucky to be able to hold that together. But subsequently, they did these amazing mega stadium tours in the States, and there was a lot of pressure. Mick Jones in particular, there was two sides to the Clash, if you like. There was a kind of like, I want to be a rock star, and there was this kind of like, oh, I'm not sure if I want to be a rock star. So Joe was particularly torn between this kind of like big amount of fame and stuff. Mick had always wanted that, and, you know, reading back into his kind of history, you know, there was a Viv Albertine book last year, I think it was a year before, and she was Mick's girlfriend for quite a long time, but she writes that, you know, he was there, you know, pumping money into this phone box in the art college, trying to get people arranged, trying to get people to come and play and rehearsals and stuff. He obviously wanted that, and you know, some people like have a pop at Mick about that, but he wanted it, and, you know, he got there, and all credit to him, really. Joe was, found that difficult. I think he was, you know, the ordinary Joe, but he also, you know, had that kind of front man for the Clash sort of thing going on as well. That, I think, caused a lot of kind of, you know, problems for the band. Mick didn't turn up for rehearsals and stuff, and the other guys were waiting around for him, and I think it just got too much, and eventually, post Combat Rock and post their sort of American tour, he got his marching orders and his check. And that's, again, I cover that a little bit in the book, but it's kind of, there's quite a bit about that written as well.
The album was actually recorded in three studios from 1981. New York is where they started off, laying down the first tracks on the album. And then the band returned to London for most of January 82 to work on the album again. And then between January and March, the Clash embarked on a six-week tour of Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong and Thailand. As you say there, Tim, it must have, as you said, it must have put tremendous stresses and strain on them, working themselves into the ground, really.
Well, they did, literally, because they had this famous record company deadline to produce the album by, you know, a certain date. I mean, ideally they wanted that album out, Combat Rock, out before Christmas, you know, to catch that kind of big market, but they were still like crunching away in the studio there and mixing and remixing. So the night before they went to Japan, Mick Jones and Joe Strummer were actually still in the studio trying to mix this album. They had to get a taxi, last minute dash to the airport and all this kind of stuff. So they were doing this kind of Far East tour, and at the same time they were trying to arrange studio time to mix the album, because it still wasn't mixed. So they got to, in Australia, they booked some studio time to mix this album, but they were doing it after they played for 2 hours. They would go off into the studio. So you imagine you playing on stage for 2 hours with, like, you know, that incredible noise that they would make, and then you're going into a studio and you're trying to like mix tracks. It was a bit of a disaster in that respect. So, the Vice tour was very interesting. I did a lot of work on that. I contacted a load of people in Australia and New Zealand. I got loads of kind of nice little anecdotes and stuff. I even tracked down this guy who was at this gig in Thailand. They did one gig in Thailand, Bangkok University. And this guy from Canada I tracked him down on the internet, and he gave this fantastic little piece that I included in the book. And his name is Dusty DeLuce, and he was, you know, that was just great. That was a real winner for me. I tried to get people involved in the book that, you know, you wouldn't normally get in books. You know, I haven't really talked to any of the band. They said their piece, I believe, on that. So I've tried to look at it from the guy, the kind of backroom guys, the guys who don't get a lot of kind of attention or whatever, you know, the graphic design guy. I just try to make it a little more interesting.
We just got time, unfortunately, Tim, to promote the book. There's a limited edition version, which is out online with a Japanese obi and sticker in it. Just a few seconds to say where people can get hold of the book if they want it.
Okay, I've managed to get Relevant Records just down the road from where we are on Mill Road. Andy in the store has agreed to stock this book for me. If you're in London, I know you're probably not in London, Sister Ray Records, big shop in Berwick Street, London, they are also stocking this. You can get it online. I have got some on Amazon, and I've got my own website, and there's a Facebook page. If you want to, there's an email address, which is info@stay-free.co.uk. That will get to me directly.
Tim, thanks very much. That's about all time we have for Tim Sasherell. Thank you very much for coming in and seeing us today.